the views of commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. It is critical to the safety and security of this country that we improve the sharing of terrorism, homeland security, and weapons of mass destruction-related information across federal, state, local, private sector, and international partners. When examining the full scope of information sharing and protection, there are many widespread and complex challenges that must be addressed and solved by multiple agencies and organizations together. The risk of a future WikiLeaks incident can be reduced, but fixing these government-wide challenges is complex, difficult, and requires sustained commitment. To do this right involves cultivating a horizontal, cross-cutting, data-centric information sharing and protection capability. What is the information sharing environment? How is information sharing maturing across the ISE? What are the biggest challenges facing the ISE? And to what extent does the pursuit of standards limit or defeat innovation? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Shmendra, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Kruser. George, welcome.
Thank you.
Shmendra, before we delve into specific initiatives, I think it would be helpful to provide some context. So what exactly is the Information Sharing Environment, or ISE? And perhaps you could offer some practical ways of thinking about this concept.
That's a great question. I get that a lot. The ISE is a complicated topic. The way I think about it is that the ISE is a collection of normalized mission and technical capabilities distributed and decentralized across all of our mission partners, federal, state, local, tribal, and private sector entities. The ISE is delivered by interconnecting existing networks, systems, and databases, working with industry and standards bodies to adopt required standards and other frameworks. The ISE harmonizes and standardizes information processes based on shared mission equities. And finally, the ISE strengthens information safeguardings, including protecting privacy, civil liberties, and civil rights of the American people. A practical way of thinking about the ISE is to think of it as an information analog to the interstate highway system. The same way the interstate highway system knit together this country post-World War II, the ISE is intended to be the information fabric enabling whole-of-government responses to national security and public safety challenges that face our nation.
Would you give us an overview of the history and evolving mission of the Office of the Program Manager for Information Sharing Environment? What was the genesis for creating this government-wide entity, and how has its mandate evolved to date?
Absolutely. My office is a core part of the government's response post-9/11. It was called for directly by the 9/11 Commission. A series of seminal reports issued by the Markle Foundation in the last decade really sketched out in great detail the vision for the information sharing environment. The statutory and policy core for the office come from three pillars: the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, Executive Order 13388, further strengthening terrorism-related information sharing, and the 2007 National Strategy for Information Sharing. From our inception, our office has had a particular focus in two areas. First, the domestic information sharing architecture, really the nexus between public safety and national security, what some in the law enforcement community talk about in terms of the nexus between homeland security and hometown security. Second, our office has had a focus on identifying, integrating, and disseminating best practices around responsible information sharing, management, and integration. really a direct line from the government reform efforts around information resources management that were anticipated with legislation like Clinger-Cohen, the eGov Act of 2002, FISMA, the Privacy Act, and other related legislation.
With such a critical cross-agency, government-wide mission, I'd like to get a sense of the scale of operation you support. Would you describe how the PMISE is organized, the size of its budget, the number of full-time employees, and what are the core communities your efforts work across and why?
My office has just under 30 government employees. About half are agency assignees working on specific projects on behalf of those agencies or detailees. We have a number of contractors augmenting our government team with specific skills. We're organized into four divisions plus two supporting teams. The four divisions are mission programs. That's where we do our work with state and local law enforcement and other mission programs across the government. Standards and architecture, which is a primary touch point with industry. Assured interoperability, which is more like a technical CIO program coordination function. And management and oversight, and that's where we do performance budget integration, strategy, policy, and governance work. The two supporting teams, which work across all four divisions, are stakeholder engagement and staff operations. The budget's between $20 to $25 million a year. Under a third goes to pay for government employees and administrative sort of fee expenses. Over a third goes to support our contractors, contract workforces, and about a third goes to support what we call our implementation fund. Kind of a unique capability of our office is our ability to seed fund, and we usually co-invest with agency mission partners to accelerate development of the ISE. A great example of that is the work we did to nurture the nationwide suspicious activity reporting initiative. Over the last number of years, we've invested about $15 million in the NSI with agency partners like FBI, DOJ, DHS. That's been a flagship of our office and a big success. Just under 300,000 frontline officers are now trained in the 16 behaviors that are reasonably indicative of terrorism-related activity or pre-operational criminal planning. We have privacy policies in all of the states that are as comprehensive as the presidential ISE privacy guidelines. 20,000 suspicious activity reports have been vetted to the functional standard we publish and maintain. And the FBI has opened up about 1,000 cases around SAR-like activity or SARs coming out of the NSI or their eGuardian application, which is part of the Nationwide Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative. So that's an example of how we use our implementation fund to help accelerate implementation of the ISE.
I'd like to delve into your specific role as the program manager for the information sharing environment. So, you know, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your specific responsibilities, and then you know, given that this doesn't really have an operational mandate, how you use your soft power in order to get things done?
That's a really good question because we are not in the chain of command. My specific responsibilities as program manager are to plan for, oversee the agency-based build-out, and manage the information sharing environment. The president, via the Director of National Intelligence, has also delegated his responsibilities as it relates to the information sharing environment, in particular implementing the five guidelines. I mentioned privacy before. The other guidelines are things like common standards, a common framework for sharing between federal, state, local, tribal, and private sector, controlled unclassified information, which has now moved to NARA, and international information sharing. We do that across the five communities, law enforcement, homeland security, intelligence, defense, foreign affairs. Additionally, the White House sets annual priorities through programmatic guidance that issued jointly between the National Security Staff and OMB to the agencies. How do we actually operate? What does soft power look like for us? Really, I put it into three buckets. We have a top-down, we have a bottom-up, and we have an outside-in. And I talk about these at length in the annual report to Congress we just delivered. You can find that on our website, www.ise.gov. Let me talk about each of those buckets where we, you know, our soft power resides. First, we have the top-down. I co-chair a White House policy committee around information sharing and access. We work closely with OMB on implementation guidance to the agencies, budget performance integration, performance metrics. The softest tool we have, but probably the most powerful, is our ability to identify best practices. Right? Over time, that really does work. And so we have the, you know, what we think and what we've heard from others is probably the leading information integration framework in the public sector around responsible information sharing. So, you know, we've got that top-down, both legal and moral authority, leadership capability. So that's kind of the first pillar. The second pillar is the bottom up. We've, since inception, been very strongly focused on the domestic architecture, information sharing, intelligence domestically. Our strongest advocates are the state and local agencies, the law enforcement community, that have seen themselves become fully integrated partners into the national information sharing architecture, the National Network of Fusion Centers. Suspicious activity reporting are two sort of flagships there. So that, you know, that bottom up. And in particular, these stakeholders and more broadly, other stakeholders view us as an honest broker, you know, where we're able to bring in their requirements, listen to them, give them a way to plug into national policy conversations around responsible information sharing. So we've got the top down, we've got the bottom up, but even that's not enough. We have a third area where I refer to as outside in. That's really our work with industry, right? This is around maturing our standards, working with industry and standards organizations around our standards, interoperability standards framework, looking at opportunities to better leverage procurement policy, to use standards so that government can buy interoperable solutions that can together plug in and create the capabilities required to be delivering the information sharing environment. You know, on this last one, there's three great examples. One is the Federal CIO Council's work on the Federal Identity Credential and Access Management Roadmap. We're fully aligned with that, and that's the basis of the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. We're seed funding a project jointly with GSA called a Backend Attribute Exchange that'll support attribute-based access control to data across mission partners, federal, state, local. Second is the National Information Exchange Model. That's at the heart of our standards framework, and we've done a lot of interesting work there. You know, and third, we've been working with the American Council on Technology Industry Advisory Committee with our partners at GSA to get recommendations about how to better leverage standards in the government's procurement process.
So there's certainly a lot of responsibilities there, kind of sticking with the power of three, with the three buckets you talked about. I'm interested in what the three biggest challenges you face are.
There's actually four I'd like to highlight. Hopefully you'll let me sneak in a little bit of a scope creep on this one. The number one issue is 11 years post 9/11, retaining the urgency and prioritization of accelerating responsible information sharing. That's the, you know, kind of our number one challenge. We've had a lot of progress. We've made progress. Last year at the 10-year anniversary, commentators inside, outside of the government all recognized the progress we've made on information sharing post 9/11. But there's more work to do, and it requires focus and prioritization. The number two challenge is new, and it's just as big as the structural financial challenge faced by agencies in the public sector. It's bad at the federal level. It's much worse at the state and local level. Number three is the evolving and increasingly integrated threats that span national security and public safety missions. And four is the tsunami of information and the imperative to correlate disparate bits of information across the distributed ISE. We're, you know, there's lots of data, and I think this is something I'd like to talk about a little bit more. Now, what are we doing about these things? On the first two, retaining the urgency and the structural financial challenges, we think they go together. Part of our challenge in the ISE is to continue to make sure we're relevant to the top priorities of our stakeholders in the Congress and the executive, the agencies, and so forth. We think that there's an efficiencies imperative that actually gets realized by our work on responsible information sharing. We think the tools that we're talking about, the best practices approach to information sharing, integration, and management will reduce duplication and redundancy, allow for increases in productivity. So we think that there's opportunities there. You know, in terms of the third thing I mentioned, the evolving threats, integrated threats, we're seeing that our mission partners increasingly want to leverage the assets we've put in place as a community, the National Network of Fusion Centers, for example, to address additional threat areas. Now, that's always been the vision. You know, and finally, in terms of the volumes of data, we see our best practices approach to responsible information sharing as a key contribution. An example here is we're working with several agencies, DHS, NCTC, others, to improve how terrorism-related data sets move across the government. So as we're able to implement enterprise data management ideas, we can develop repeatable processes and leverage shared services. You know, that'll result in efficiencies over time and improve data quality, which will improve the mission performance.
That's a great segue into understanding. Given your unique role of your office, what are the characteristics of an effective leader?
My answer is colored by my training as an engineer and entrepreneur. Lots of different management styles, but I definitely have a point of view. So I break that into two parts, thought leadership and leading transformation. I believe that thought leaders must start with partnerships and listening to practitioners at all levels and be able to integrate and put forward an informed and credible vision rooted in informed and organized bodies of knowledge. Clearly, thought leaders have to have a point of view, right? That's the definition of a thought leader. But a thought leader without being rooted and anchored in existing knowledge and relationships and partnerships is, you know, not really useful. Now, for transformation leaders, it's absolutely essential to be credible from an operational or execution perspective. You know, you have to have a good track record, but that's only a starting point. You must extend in, you have visible listening skills, empathy for the mission, you know, demonstrating integrity in how you make decisions, clearly and predictably communicating, and transparent operation. So all of those things have to come together to create the confidence in transformation. Now, I separated the thought leadership from the transformation because they're distinct aspects of my job. What we're doing at the PMISC and what we're doing with the ISC more broadly is new. It's not like there's existing models for, you know, doing this sort of thing. As a matter of fact, if there were, the agencies could just do it. You wouldn't need to have an office like mine. But in addition to that, you know, thought leadership, laying out the vision in a credible way, in a detailed way, right, you need to execute also. So both of those things come together.
What is the national strategy for the information sharing environment? We will ask Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. Shmendra, you described the Information Sharing Environment, ISE, and the role your office plays in making it a reality. But now I'd like to talk about the strategic vision that frames it. Would you tell us more about your efforts to recraft the national strategy for the Information Sharing Environment that takes a whole-of-government approach? How does it guide the implementation of responsible information sharing and practices across the government?
You know, coming into the role, the White House asked us to take a look at refreshing the 2007 National Strategy for Information Sharing. Now, we did a tremendous amount with our mission partners and with the White House, tremendous amount of outreach and synthesis to try to, you know, look at that question. And while we were doing this, the WikiLeaks breach occurred, and that's a pretty major event. And there's been a real focus on remediating the safeguarding challenges and a real realization by all stakeholders that sharing and safeguarding are two sides of the same coin. And we need to share, but we need to share responsibly. Responsible information sharing is a one-way street. We're going down that street. So where we are right now in the process of refreshing the strategy is the White House continues to develop the new National Strategy for Information Sharing and Safeguarding, explicitly adding safeguarding. Now, we see great potential for the new National Strategy to confirm the importance of the plans we have in place, including the goals of the office, the way forward that I've described here in more detail in our annual report, and the annual planning execution we do with the interagency and our non-federal partners. We think the strategy also has further potential to assess with leveraging our tools, the tools we've created in the office, our office as a platform more broadly. Now, the new strategy doesn't replace the 2007 strategy. We think the 2007 strategy lays a solid foundation, in particular, you know, with our domestic-focused activities. The new strategy, as it's evolving, is looking to build on that solid foundation and lifts up to a stronger and more broad focus on responsible information sharing and safeguarding. We fully support the National Security Staff, who are in the late stages of shepherding the national strategy through its development and release.
What are some of the biggest challenges facing the ISE and the various agencies, communities that operate in it and own that environment? What are some of the core capabilities and tools you use to assist in overcoming these challenges and spreading the adoption, as you mentioned earlier, of best practices?
So you're asking about the view from the agencies. What I hear from my mission partners, federal, state, local, tribal, it really boils down to two themes. You know, first, they're all under varying degrees of financial pressure. It's either bad or really bad. And the degree to which working with a government-wide initiative such as the ISE is viewed as a tax versus an enabler, right, folks are wary. Second, as a government, we're still fragmented with our programmatic management processes and how we make decisions across agency and program boundaries. Now, these two themes are not new. As we think about these themes, this contributed to our view of the tools that we've developed and the top-down, bottom-up, outside-in approach that we're trying to position. By bringing in state and local agencies to the table in a coherent, clear way, the office is able to accelerate and lower risk on core federal initiatives that are aimed into that space. By working with industry and standards organizations, we enable interoperability of independently procured systems, potentially lowering risk, costs, and increasing performance. You know, two specific examples I'd like to highlight here are our implementation fund and our dispute resolution capability. You know, we make strategic seed investments with our mission partners. And what we found is that the kinds of projects we funded are projects that are of high value to the agencies that lead to the development of core capabilities of the ISE, but have an inherent risk profile around being interagency. And because of that, wouldn't normally be pursued by a specific agency. Right, but that's our sweet spot. We're able to factor those risks, and actually we've had a pretty high success rate. We're also able to facilitate the resolution of disputes. Right, we're not in the chain of command, and we can't impose any solutions, but we're an honest broker, and we're recognized as such. And we bring the variety of tools so that we can, you know, help identify creative solutions that, you know, would allow progress in previously intractable or difficult challenges.
So there are a tremendous number of concepts that sort of stream around the ISE, and I want to actually get into one particular, and that's interoperability. Could you tell us what actually it means? What does interoperability mean as respects networks and data, and why is it so important to the success of ISE?
Yeah, it's at the heart of what we do. Key to our approach to interoperability is to understand that we're focused mostly at the policy and business process level while we're looking at the complete stack, right? So where we're adding the most value is at the policy level, the business process level, the data level, and then we're leveraging and profiling, frankly, industry standard approaches at the network and lower levels. At the business process level, for example, we focus on functional standards for information exchange based on common mission equities. We use the NEEM framework, the National Information Exchange Model. And specifically within the NEEM, we use something called Information Exchange Package Descriptions, or IEPDs. While it's a long name, what it boils down to is clear, shared, and detailed use cases that precisely describe what information is shared and what context to support the mission. Right? It does it in a formal way you can then translate into, you know, logical interoperability. Now, at the network level, we align on and actively support government-wide and standards, mainstream standards kind of approaches I mentioned earlier, and I'll highlight here the Federal Identity Credential and Access Management Roadmap, right, which is the basis for the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, is driving interoperability at the identity and access control level across the government. This is important to the success of the ISE because we're focused on and work back from mission and policy requirements, whether that's privacy policy or missions like suspicious activity reporting. So by taking that focus, it's a simple idea, but the end result works. And further, since the frameworks we use are built to our functional standards are now being adopted by industry, we have a pathway to scaling. That's the outside in piece.
I'd like to delve a little bit more into the National Information Exchange Model and ask you to elaborate a little bit more on the role it plays in moving the ISE vision forward.
NEEM is at the heart of our interoperability framework. Now, NEEM has experienced tremendous uptake in the public sector. 19 federal cabinet agencies are using it. It's being adopted in Canada, Mexico, and Europe. And more importantly, industry and independent standards organizations are seeing the value, and we're aligning with that approach, so we have a pathway for greater degrees of industry engagement and involvement. We just completed an effort to align NEEM with mainstream best practices around information management and model-driven architecture via the NEEM UML profile. Now, UML is the lingua franca for information management, information modeling. With the NEEM UML profile, we're going to be able to leverage UML tools to do NEEM-based work. Now, vendors are starting to ship implementations. Quite exciting to see that. Some of the early implementations I've seen are being described as game-changing in terms of the paradigm for developing NEEM IEPDs, information exchanges, and implementing those. The skill level required is being abstracted away in the tool. It used to be that it required somebody that had a degree of XML schema, what's called XSD expertise, which is a, you know, a narrow skill set. Now, folks that are more that have the business analyst skill set and have some awareness of XML, right, are able to do the bulk of the work around developing NEEM exchange specifications. Because it's UML based too, we're expecting to see this cascade down the information lifecycle. So enterprise software vendors, for example, will start to develop support to take a NEM IEPD to develop in a more streamlined manner web services that are NEM-enabled. You know, you're starting, that's the promise of model-driven architecture, and we're actually seeing that one vendor in particular is out in front, and we expect to see multiple implementations like that over the next 12 to 18 months.
There have been significant information sharing improvements within individual agencies. Many of these have been documented. Could you tell us more about the Nationwide Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative and the extent to which it represents a foundational success for your efforts going forward? How are you building on it, and what lessons can be learned from it?
You know, we found that the Nationwide Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative allowed us to develop many aspects of the ISC in a contained, albeit national, scope environment. So the scope of the ISC is huge. The scope of NSI is still huge, but it's much more contained, and we were able to actually make progress on key aspects of the ISC. Take the ISC SAR functional standard, which defines the 16 behaviors that are reasonably indicative of pre-operational criminal planning or terrorism-related activity. This standard was developed across our stakeholder group, federal, state, local, tribal, mission operators. We tested it in an evaluation environment, 12 fusion centers. We engaged with all the privacy advocacy groups, the American Civil Liberties Union, Electronic Frontier Foundation, Center for Democracy and Technology, all of the different advocacy communities. And through that process, we were able to evolve the standard, get buy-in, be able to roll it out more broadly to where now about 300,000 frontline officers have been trained. And we're actually expanding now beyond law enforcement to the public safety community more generally. In partnership with DHS and DOJ and FBI, we use our implementation fund to seed fund the development of training with the professional societies. So we're targeting now the 2.3 million private security guards, 1.3 million firefighters, 75% of whom are volunteer, over 100,000 911 call center operators, corrections and probations, emergency management, and folks like that. So shorthand for that is what we call hometown partners, right? This idea that there's a nexus between homeland security and hometown security. And again, it's an interesting example of how our engagement model works, where we do this work in partnership with the professional societies, right, and the agencies, right, and it works pretty well, right? We're paying for the development of the training material, but the delivery of the training material, right, is all happening out in this distributed, decentralized way. Again, going back to those 300,000 police officers.
Well, you've mentioned fusion centers several times. I like to delve and explore exactly what they are. What is a fusion center, and how does the national network of fusion centers factor into your overall strategy?
Fusion centers, in this context, are the key nodes the government uses to share terrorism-related information with state and local agencies. And it's bidirectional, and it's also peer-to-peer. They're owned and operated by the states or major metropolitan areas. Two-thirds of them are run by the state police organizations in the different states, and the other third are regional or, you know, major urban area kind of fusion centers. The fusion centers are defined by four critical operating capabilities. Right, so fusion centers have the ability to receive urgent, potentially classified alerts, warnings, and notifications, conduct risk analysis based on local considerations, further disseminate required actionable information to frontline public safety partners, law enforcement, but also other public safety entities, and then gather, vet, and share information. And the flagship there, of course, is suspicious activity reporting, so it's the entire intelligence cycle. In a nutshell, fusion centers are the vehicle for integrating state, local, and tribal agencies into the information sharing environment. We're currently working to identify, integrate, and disseminate existing best practices for private sector integration leveraging fusion centers. Many fusion centers have robust liaison officer programs and have connectivity to the private sector. We think we can model those best practices and extend that more broadly to better integrate the private sector.
As you talked, literally having thousands of stakeholders in your work to help address critical law enforcement information sharing gaps, issues, and challenges, I'd like to ask you about your efforts to reinvent the public safety business model and what implications that such an effort have.
As we conducted outreach with our state and local stakeholders around the refresh of the national strategy, an overwhelming thing came back. You know, state and local agencies are getting crushed under the weight of budget cuts. Law enforcement is no different than other aspects of state and local government. Faced with the need to build on the initial successes with a national network of fusion centers and initiatives like suspicious activity reporting, evolving, increasingly integrated national and international threats, in these budget cuts, the state and local leaders we interacted with telegraphed a willingness and a sense of urgency around taking a fresh look and looking at things holistically. You know, there's a saying that's attributed to Ernest Rutherford that my boss, Director Clapper, uses, and I heard first from him. It goes something like, when you run out of money, you have to start thinking. So, you know, what we're hearing from our state and local partners, loud and clear, is it's time to attack the fragmentation in the system in a thoughtful and creative way, using information. But we're also fragmented programmatically. Think about this. We have fusion centers from the war on terror. We have HIDAs, high-intensity drug trafficking areas, from the war on drugs. We have risk centers, regional information sharing system centers, from regional organized crime. Individually, they all make sense. Collectively, can we do better? Can we look at, you know, co-location, virtualizing back-end, shared services, cloud-like approaches, standardization, and standards-based procurement? The answers are yes, 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 and yes. But it's not just about cost saving. Let me give you an example. Case and event deconfliction. Officer safety is a critical issue. Deconfliction is a key tool in terms of avoiding blue-on-blue incidents. But it's also a resource allocation tool, right? You know, if looking at case deconfliction, it's also an intelligence generation tool, right, if you're able to connect different disparate activities. So, you know, case and event deconfliction has got to be a part of, looking at reinventing the business model and as a tool to realize efficiencies as well as protect lives. We have a degree of buy-in for this idea. Right? The International Association of Chiefs of Police endorsed it in their executive committee in their big annual meeting in Chicago last year. It's an idea whose time has come, but it's a complex idea. It involves a lot of change and transformation, and it's a kind of systematic look that is overdue, but it's a multi-year, decade-long kind of transformation.
To what extent does the pursuit of standards limit or defeat innovation? We will ask Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. So standards are critical to powering the ISE. Would you tell us more about the development and implementation of standards across the environment? And more particularly, does the pursuit of standards limit or defeat innovation?
You know, I want to start with the last part of that question. We absolutely believe that standards enable innovation. You know, the key here is let's innovate where we should innovate. Let's innovate where we can add value. And let's standardize where we have defined requirements and have common mission equities and we really need to share information. So our standards framework is really focused on exchange standards. It's standards on the edges of organizations. And it's really trying to solve the problem of moving from point to point interfaces that are custom and one-off to a multilateral sort of interface exchange, which is standardized and baked into the infrastructure. You innovate on top of that. You know, why would you want to innovate on an interface spec, right? You want to innovate on analysis methodologies and things like that. Now, they are critical to our activities, and you know, we're firm believers in the nexus for standards being with industry, right, with voluntary consensus standard type organizations. So along those lines, we've set up something called the Standards Coordinating Council. It is within our White House-based IPC structure, and this coordinating council includes right now organizations like OASIS, the Object Management Group, the Open Geospatial Consortium, the IGIS Institute, ACT-IAC, AFEI, which is in the DOD space, and we're looking to grow it, but these are folks that we work with right now on specific aspects of the ISE standards profile. We also have a standards working group that's focused inside the government, where we're trying to coordinate standards activities, standards repositories, how we think about standards, how they integrate into programmatic management processes. We're also looking at industry-based certification, right? The idea here is not to create a heavyweight infrastructure, but to make this lightweight and to make sure that it works with industry, not against industry, right? So that's really, really critical. And so standards are critical to empowering the ISE, and we think the nexus with the standards work is work with industry and standards organizations.
The need to both protect and share national security and counterterrorism-related information is critical. To that end, can you elaborate on your efforts to develop and implement safeguarding capabilities that directly relate to the advancement of information sharing?
Yes, we look at safeguarding, protecting information, information security as two sides of the same coin with information sharing. As a matter of fact, when you look at the definition of the ISE in law, the ISE is defined through 15 performance attributes, the majority of which either are security related or dual purpose, things like attribute-based access control, cross-security domain, sharing of information, audit and continuous monitoring, things like that. So it's been a part of our fabric since inception. We've done a lot of work to date around security policy type activities. More recently, and also the identity management sort of activities we talked about earlier, more recently we've been given the mission and we've stood up and integrated the Classified Information Sharing and Safeguarding Office as part of the government's response post-WikiLeaks. So in that regard, we're working closely with the Committee on National Security Systems, which is out in front with a secret fabric and driving a lot of activities that way with the Insider Threat Task Force to make sure that there's an integrated approach, right, to make sure that we're leveraging and not forgetting information sharing and the safeguarding, but really always coming back to, you know, the key is responsible information sharing. So the things you would do to enable information sharing also enable safeguarding. It's, in our view, not a trade-off. It's not an either-or, it's a both.
Your success clearly rests in part on, you know, building both a shared trust and a shared responsibility related to the overall national security mission. Can you tell us how the ISE governance structure works and how it helps to both build that trust and that shared responsibility?
Yes, yes. As I mentioned, I co-chair the White House's Information Sharing and Access Policy Committee. My other co-chair is my co-chair is Tim Duran, Senior Director for Information Sharing and Safeguarding Policy on the National Security Staff. So Tim and I co-chair the IPC, Interagency Policy Committee. We have several subcommittees and working groups underneath the IPC. These subcommittees and working groups have a degree of agency leadership. Almost in every case, actually, we try to recruit people from the interagency to be the leaders in the subcommittees and working groups. So I'll highlight our privacy subcommittee. We have a privacy, civil liberty, civil rights subcommittee. The current chair of that committee is Alex Joel. He's the chief privacy, civil liberties officer in the ODNI. Previously, he just took over from Mary Ellen Callahan, who just left Federal Service. She was a chief privacy officer over at DHS. Chief privacy officers from across the government sit on this subcommittee working different issues around helping agencies build their privacy policies, you know, how do we look at compliance or performance measures around privacy, how do we standardize information sharing agreements, these privacy by design ideas I talked about earlier. They've got a working group looking at that sort of thing. So, you know, that kind of broad-based buy-in. Another example of this is that we've gone through the process, and it was a process, but we've successfully navigated it to include non-federal players in our subcommittees and working groups. Now, that's a pretty big deal for folks that have been around the government. The fact that we can actually, in a national policy body, a White House-based policy body, we're able to have subcommittees where we've integrated state and local representatives. So the chair and the vice chair of the Criminal Intelligence Coordinating Council, for example, Ron Brooks is the chair, and Vern Keenan, who's the vice chair, they sit on both the SAR subcommittee and the Fusion Center subcommittee. We have representation from Global, their infrastructure committee, in our information integration subcommittee. So having that state and local participation is a big deal. It sends a great message. Now, in addition to the governance, there's also the engagement type activities, right? So we do a lot of engagement, and we work that, you know, through a variety of different organizations. But there's a real focus on leveraging professional societies. So An example there is the International Association of Chiefs of Police. We do a lot with the IACP. They're an incredible partner for us. By working with them, that's how we can actually touch the 18,000 police departments in a credible way. Them and others like the National Sheriff's Association, the major city chiefs, the major county sheriffs. So there's other organizations, but I just was highlighting IACP.
Now, given that threats can come from across the world or across the street, I'd like to understand how you're better working with the private sector and international partners on expanding responsible information sharing. More particularly, how are you enhancing the exchange of best practices and ideas amongst these folks?
Well, on the best practices, and it's very interesting, we're getting a lot of demand actually from our international partners. People overseas are taking notice of the work we've been doing and wanting to collaborate. I'll give you a few examples. There's an activity, North America Day, mm-hmm. and we're meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia, end of August. And there it's the CIOs and CIO, their associates, the federal CIO types from the three countries, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. So last year in Mexico City, I was part of the delegation. We executed an agreement between the three countries to share best practices. And there was a focus on the national information exchange model. We kicked off two pilot projects, and we've had some success with them. One on public safety, stolen vehicle information sharing. The other, public health, foodborne illness. The stolen vehicle one is one you might understand, right, because of our public safety sort of nexus. But so let me talk about the other one, public health, foodborne illness. The Centers for Disease Control here in the U.S. has been out in front on that with their counterparts in Canada and Mexico. They've been developing some information exchanges that are standardized. They've been able to leverage some existing systems and build a consistent exchange across the systems. It's pilot. It's not in production because there are some issues that they're going to work around authority to operate CNA type stuff and things like that. But we always kind of said initially it was just going to be a pilot with to just approve the concept. But they're very bullish on it. As a matter of fact, the feedback we're getting from the three countries is that they want to take what we've done to the World Health Organization and sponsor it for further dissemination more broadly. And the biggest proponents of doing that are our partners in Mexico, actually. Very, very interesting and compelling. So in addition, we've seen some uptake in Europe. We've been working with the European Commission folks, or the equivalent of their eGov function, around semantic interoperability ideas. The NEEM program office is doing that. And we've been working with our partners in the interagency with Europol, Pan-European Criminal Intelligence Fusion Center. That's where they do transnational organized crime, terrorism, and cyber. They're adopting our frameworks and wanting to collaborate. And so that's very exciting to see.
Our listeners have heard a lot about successful, responsible information sharing is dependent on really changing the culture from one of a need to know to a need to share. And we also hear things like we need to move from information owners to information stewards. I'm interested in your thinking on those two concepts of, A, is that in fact required for responsible information sharing? And if so, what kind of progress has been made in the last few years?
That's a great question, and it goes to the heart of how we see our mission. I'm going to anchor back on something the Markle Foundation put forward. Markle championed several years ago the idea of authorized use. Right. So the idea of authorized use is really focused on, decisions people need to make to protect the American people and enhance national security. So the whole point of information sharing is not to share information, but to get information to decision makers so they can make better, more proactive decisions to, further the mission. Right. So that's what authorized use is all about. Right. Being able to think about information sharing in a mission context and defining policy that way as opposed to defining policy from the perspective of classes of information. Now, I look at that as also this idea of moving from ownership to stewardship. But the key challenge you have there is that we have, law, policy, decades-long focus on classes of information. So how do you actually make that transition? So we have to do it incrementally and stepwise. And this goes to the heart of what we're trying to do, is to get folks comfortable with the idea that, yes, there can be a stewardship model versus an ownership model. Now, keys to doing that are things like trust that policies are defined in a way that are clearly understood across organizational boundaries. So, and that understanding has to be in detail, not at the high level. So, you can't just have a high-level policy and leave implementation to different agencies, right? Because then you're going to get variation in implementations, and you're not going to get kind of consistent enforcement of those policies. So this is where the things like the smart data ideas, the back-end attribute exchange ideas, having, you know, privacy guidelines that, you know, anchor across levels of government become key enablers to taking that journey. We have many more steps to take, but I think it's, you know, some of the things that we're talking about will enable that sort of trust. You know, and it all boils down to the producers of information and consumers of information operating off the same rule book, right, in a way that's transparent and auditable across, you know, across boundaries.
How are you using social mapping tools or social networking tools?
We see the need to build communities of action around information sharing. So we've, you know, knowledge management's a key issue for us. So being able to, you know, build from the initial release, we have this Building Blocks initiative that I talked about that's highlighted in our website, www.isc.gov. We think that there's a need to be able to identify information sharing professionals across ISC mission partners. I've talked about how large our scope is. Well, across those mission partners, there are individuals that want to be able to participate in, you know, the development of the ISC, contributing their best practices, understanding what others are doing. And so, you know, the Building Blocks initiative is really the first step in that direction. We want to take it. Right now it's static, right? We're just publishing best practices across the ISC. We want to, you know, take it to where it's more dynamic, where we're integrating academics or think tanks or other third parties that are credibly dedicated to the mission of identifying, disseminating knowledge around the information sharing mission space, right? And then be able to have those sort of online communities that, you know, I think could, you know, allow us to accelerate innovation, accelerate identification, integration, and dissemination of best practices.
What does the future hold for the information sharing environment? We will ask Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for ISE, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. So there's a perception that there's a very high ratio of noise to signal in all this data being collected. What are you doing to better extract the necessary signals from the abundant noise, and how do you raise the signal and decrease the noise?
This is an accurate perception. It's real. I talked earlier about the challenges we have with the tsunami of information. And, you know, kind of the good news here is that we've been making progress. The bad news is we're making progress and we got to go to the next level, right, which is attacking this sort of issue of high signal to noise. We think that our best practices information integration framework that I've talked about really offers a solution here. As we move from point-to-point bilateral information sharing to multilateral ISE-wide information sharing, you're going to have greater degrees of consistency and quality and timeliness at the data and closer to the source of data collection or production, right? So then having that improved data quality will allow you to more quickly and easily, with higher degrees of assurance, establish linkages between disparate pieces of information. You know, also by having effective enterprise-wide, enterprise here being the ISE data management sort of schemes in place, you can move away from moving big bulk data sets and move towards publishing out rules, filters, triggers closer to the edge, right? So that, you know, you can reduce the amount of information that's actually moving or the percentage of information. Clearly, the volumes are going to keep increasing, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, it's definitely things that I think we're going to be able to, you know, help out on.
You've mentioned earlier that at the state, local, tribal levels, there's a sense of this crushing fiscal austerity being placed on them. While you didn't highlight at the federal level, but I think even at the federal level, we're seeing that there's not an endless stream of money anymore. In the face of asking employees to constantly do more with less, how do you keep your team motivated when there is all this dire financial information behind us or around us?
Well, I'll answer that question on two levels. First, internal to the office, then the extended team across the ISE. So internal to the office, we have a pretty good culture that's focused on mission enablement. And the people that work at the PMISE every day, for the most part, almost exclusively are there because they believe in the mission, they want to make a difference, and they're seeing that their efforts actually do make a tangible difference across the ISE to accelerate the ISE and support the, you know, the public safety national security mission we have. So it's that mission focus that keeps people, and that's why many people come, most people come into public service to begin with, is that mission focus. And again, because of, you know, where we sit aligned with the White House, the scope of our work, you know, they're able to see a more clear line between their individual contribution and accelerating the ISE. More broadly in the interagency, you're definitely seeing folks kind of struggling with cuts and lack of resources and a need to transform. There again, though, I think many of the folks that are working these ISE initiatives are seeing them as part of the solution, not part of the problem, in terms of moving towards shared approaches, more efficient uses of information, reducing, you know, redundancy and duplication and things like that. So again, I think it's seeing themselves as, you know, part of the solution. And I think that's critical.
Passion for the mission certainly can be a powerful draw to get the right resources into government initially. But, you know, we're seeing the skill set needed is just constantly changing. So how do you make sure that you keep a well-trained, proficient workforce going, just, you know, in light of all the changes in technology and skill set?
That's a great question. You know, early on, I talked about the structure of the office. We have an incredibly diverse workforce. It's diverse demographically, but it's diverse from a life experience perspective, professional experience. We have folks that have, you know, been career law enforcement, as well as, you know, folks that are intimately involved in budget performance integration, right, and everybody that spans in between. So we've created a culture in the office that's what I call whole of office. It really is focused on teamwork. So we don't expect individuals to come in and span the mission space, span the skill set. We expect them to, you know, be able to work collaboratively in the office and then more broadly with our partners in the interagency. Now, the second part of this is that, you know, we've always put a premium on partnership and engagement with non-federal partners, federal partners, but people outside the office. So I highlighted, for example, the Standards Coordinating Council and those different organizations. Let me make a plug for folks to get involved and engaged. You know, we're very cognizant of the fact that expertise resides all through the community, much of it outside the government. And many folks want to participate in constructive solutions to the challenges I've outlined. So get involved through the different organizations I highlighted, the Object Management Group, OASIS, the IGIS Institute, which is focused on public safety, technology, and information sharing, AFEI, Open Geospatial Consortium, ACT-IAC. All of these organizations are actively involved in the Standards Coordinating Council. We're coordinating activity, but the work's happening in those different groups, right? And whether you're a federal person or whether you're a non-federal person, get engaged and help contribute, be a part of the solution.
This has been a wonderful and very informative conversation, but I'd like to transition to the future. What are some of the major opportunities and challenges you think your organization will face? And more importantly, how do you think you'll evolve to meet these challenges and seize these opportunities?
Well, that's a great question. It's difficult to read the future. I think what we're seeing is that we're getting traction across our efforts, across the ISE, and we're scaling up to a portfolio of activities. I go back to the buckets of the top down, bottom up, outside in. That's working. And there's a synergy between those activities. So I think that in the next year, the next 5 years, as you're laying out the timeline, that traction will become increasingly visible to folks that are